Okay, we'll make a start. Welcome to those joining us for the first time this afternoon, and also a welcome to those who are rejoining us from this morning. My name's Andrew Dewdney. I'm from London South Bank University, and I'm one of the co-investigators on the AHRC-funded project Cultural Value and the Digital Practice, Policy and Theory. That's the grand research title. I'll just restate what Victoria said this morning, just to plug us into this particular strand. This strand, which is taking place today and tomorrow, and this is what we said. We said, for cultural institutions, the term digital access describes online practices and knowledge of users, software systems, and the interface values established by the online practice of museums and archives. This strand of our research aims to look at the current state of practice, knowledge, and understanding of this policy term, and aims to examine what problems and opportunities are posed by working with users and their online behaviors, as well as the problems presented by the digitization of archives and collection practices. And it's that latter part that we're looking at this morning. This morning we tended to focus on the idea of the online user and the problems of trying to communicate and identify who these users are. This afternoon we're switching our focus much more to something that's actually been a longer history, really, which is museums and archives and libraries digitizing collection. That must be a project of at least, 15 years? The experts in the room might say it's even longer. Specifically for this afternoon, we said the digitization of archives and museum collections have been underway for over two decades. But in archival terms, only a small fraction of analog collections are available online. What problems have emerged for the museum in the digitization of analog objects, and how are online collections being used in network culture? So I think we will have a good time this afternoon discussing that. And I think our contributors to this afternoon will have a lot to help us mull over and think about in discussion. So I'd like to welcome Jennifer Mundy, who is Head of Collection Research at Tate and leads a team within the research department that publishes online materials about the collection. Jennifer is going to speak first, and then I'd also like to welcome Sonia Lopez, who is webmaster and head of digital publications at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Barcelona, MACBA. And I'd also like to welcome Magritte Chavamaca, who is curator and head of research and publications at the Stedelijk Museum, Amsterdam, who's also very involved in this. Similar questions to, I think, this research project. Okay, so Jennifer.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the invitation. A couple of months ago, I was asked to do a similar talk reflecting on the impact of the digital on collection research, and I, with your permission, I'm going to slightly just rehash that, partly because I was also asked, within the 5 minutes allotted, to talk about the lessons learned. And I hope maybe some of those comments might be a platform for the discussion. So, and I was also asked to reflect on a project I was involved in. I curated an online exhibition called Lost Art, so there'll be two parts to this. And I hope, all in all, that will give something of where part of Tate is at the moment. I could have talked about the digitization of archives, which is a major project currently, but someone else would have been better placed to do that, so I'm not even going to attempt. So this is what I'm going to talk about, really, just impact, reasons, things learnt, and I'll try to do it very, very fast. The next three slides just illustrate where we've gone in terms of publishing, and I am going to be talking about the digital really and largely in terms of a publishing platform, for the most part. So, the next thing on I'm going to show you is the same work, but then in the 90s we publish a volume, we have a 2.5 pages and illustrations. And that shows those sort of changes between from the 60s to the 90s. And this is where we are now. This is Tate's research page. So this is where you can see what the impact of the digital has been and the journey that we have all gone on from this, the last few decades. In broad terms, therefore, I think the digital is allowing a broader vision for collection research. Entries are no longer the be-all and end-all of museum scholarship, by no means at all. So we have research projects, we have many voices, we try and employ different perspectives, not a single narrative. One text equal has been shifted through to different formats and different levels, and the new collaborations has changed our research methods and our approach. New competencies we've all had to learn in the last decade, the digital world, new formats, and of course, I genuinely believe new audiences. Just to just keep on this theme about what the digital has done, it has provided more. It has provided the platform for more text. So this is the Turner project we published a year or so ago. At only one third complete, we were able to publish 3 million words. This is inconceivable in terms of traditional publishing. With the Camden Town project, we were allowed to, digital allowed us to include different types of materials, audio, films, interactive maps. More context. So around an artwork, you can have preliminary works, you can have images of letters, all these things that we now take for granted, but it still is so recent, I still regard it as worth saying. This is a change. And of course, films. Films showing us conservators talking, curators talking, historical films. Films of displays to record the experiences that the museum can offer. And new disciplinary perspectives. Although artistry is still a privileged discipline, digital allows us to bring different voices and different people coming together. And in this project, an Egyptologist really helped solve a big problem around 19th century Victorian sculpture. Digital arguably also allows us to see art better. These are close-ups of Henry Moore sculptures. We're doing a Henry Moore project. You can publish these things in a way that you'd never, ever be able to publish in a book form. So the close-ups, the behind the scenes, there are just more images, more things to see. And of course, that really does raise ultimately the question is, what is the best way to see a work of art? Is it to see it in the museum, digital, or do we throw away the question, what is best? They're just different. And of course, a larger, more diverse, more international audience. These figures are based on a survey that was done very, very recently, and I don't know if Elena covered this when she talked to you, but it's really a stunning step forward and proof that whatever else one says about the digital, we know that people want information. They may want other things as well, but they do want information. So essentially, just under half of UK visitors came to the website looking for information, not just how to buy a ticket, not just what to plan their visit, but for information that they wanted to use. And over half international audiences, it's two-thirds, wanted information. So roughly speaking, half our audiences come to the website for information. And these are the sort of figures we're getting for our very quite complicated scholarly projects. Again, they beat online book publishing into a corner, essentially. Those are pretty good figures. Okay, there's a difference between a page view and someone buying a book, but nonetheless, in terms of reach. It hasn't been all plain sailing. There are negative perceptions to this day, inside and outside of the museum, about online scholarly publishing. I list some of the still quite commonly held views. So it's trivial, it's a place of amusement, it's short-lived, it's badly maintained, poorly designed, and there are issues around the design of materials that we publish. And there's still a strong belief in some sectors that curators, scholars, are not particularly interested in online. I think the world might be divided into two. There are those who are passionate about it and those who still resist. But whilst we're all probably in the room, we're all in love with the digital. And just we have to remember there are lots of people who say, I would rather publish in a small monograph that might be read by 500 people, because that is where I should be publishing my material. And also, even the website, there is a very, within the museum, there's still a strong sector of people who will say that actually research is a very minority interest. It's not something for the mass public, therefore we shouldn't pay too much attention to it. I think the figures about what people are using the website for can counterbalance that argument. And there's obviously debate about the degree to which research is public-facing or not. Lessons learnt. Well, in the few years ago, there used to be a big debate around that the museum was a real place and the website was an ancillary, virtual, not so important place, and that all, everything the museum should be doing was be to get people to come to the museum. I think that that has all long gone, particularly with the philosophy that the digital is a dimension of everything that we've already heard about. I would say that the digital doesn't exist just in the Wild West. It is framed, and one of the successes of research publishing at Tate has been simply on the back of in exploiting Tate's brand value. And I do think that you need to understand that digital assets, the value that they carry has a context, and I would really stress that element. A lesson learned is that our digital outputs have allowed us to get research funding, but that's a small point, perhaps. But I would also say that in a way that's under-recognised, that the digital can be a sphere for creative thinking. And I personally adore the fact you can get instant feedback through numbers, however raw they are potentially fascinating. And I think more external authors are willing to publish with us as research publishing online becomes better established. Although I will confess that our research projects haven't got academic reviews in the Burlington or the Apollo, which was a shame. For me, it was a disappointment. I hoped that the quality and the breadth and the depth of the projects would have attracted the same coverage that an academic volume would have done. Moving on, the last point is my personal credo that scholarly outputs are for everybody, and you cannot predict who wants them or how they would use the information. And we tend to, in Tate research, frame our research in a way that should always be accessible and clear. So looking forward, I think more public engagement is the way ahead, and we are finding new formats, new ways of reaching people at different levels and conveying our research findings in ways that leapfrog over the barriers to communication that academic research publishing have normally suffered from. Twitter is welcome, in other words, it's one way of putting it. And I think, as I was going to say, that the digital can be an innovative sphere, and I think that's probably something that's not been entirely recognised by those who just see it as a publishing platform. And I, at this point, I will talk about a project I was involved in, which was a partnership between Tate, Channel 4, and a media design company called ISO, the Gallery of Lost Art. It was an online exhibition that lasted for 1 year. And it had a strong thesis, not particularly stunningly original, perhaps, but nonetheless some clear messages, which we wanted to put across because they hadn't featured in conventional art history. So we were looking at artworks from the modern period that had disappeared, had been lost, had been stolen, had gone up in flames, had been bombed, had been destroyed, had been mislaid. And showed how that had shaped art history. So I'm showing you a slide of Guernica when it was first displayed. And one of the aspects of the fame of Guernica was that it's one of the largest and unique expressions of political resistance not just because it was done by Picasso, it's famous because it was unique in its scale. But actually, it wasn't. There was Miro's The Reaper, which exhibited at the same time, same scale, same degree of political comment, but because it was lost in a few years afterwards, only existed in a few very poor photographs, it's been written out of art history. So the project was about recovering some of those stories. It was also to point to the rather obvious fact, but one we tend not to focus on, that loss is a major part of art's history, and it's an accepted part of contemporary, well, modern and contemporary practice. And I'm showing you here a Christo piece. One thing I learnt and learnt to focus on more through this Lost Art project was that artworks have an extended life. They have a period, I think, possibly sometimes before they come into existence, and they have a long period after they may have ceased to have a material existence. And I think that idea of the life of an object, of an idea and its ancillary ecology, I think sometimes it could be a rather useful idea to get away from straightforward dichotomy of something that's real and existent and something that's virtual and not real. Understanding the layers of the creative life of an object, so that here we're looking at Sutherland's portrait of Winston Churchill. You can see it again in the film when Winston Churchill accepted the portrait unwillingly, and you can have artists commenting on the story of what it feels like to be as a portrait artist to be rejected by your sitter. So and this has a story of the famous story of the rejection by Churchill of his portrait. Ultimately, he had it destroyed. How this affected subsequent life. So we did 40 such case stories, and one of the key things we wanted to do with this project was to try and create an online exhibition, which was not a resource, which was not just images and text, that had a space, an actual space, a metaphorical space, as it were, a virtual space. And so we created and then this is to distinguish it from the sort of projects which you can see here, which are just flat. This is called an online exhibition. It's Cindy Sherman at MoMA. It's beautifully designed, wonderful resource. But what you get are a series of images and text. It's not an online exhibition that exploits the three dimensions or sensory experiences. It doesn't offer an immersive experience. And even things which are immersive, as it were, which give you the third dimension, such as Google's art project, they are very much they treat the visitor as a seeing eye, a machine, the camera, whereas the exhibition, in any real exhibition, and any the online exhibition we wanted to create, we were talking about a sensory experience, and I feel that Google doesn't give you a sensory experience, really. So these are sort of images from the project, and you can see there's a lot of text produced around the project, and we also had a space for engagement, blogs, comments, and we asked visitors, and we gave them cues to explore the material. It was laid out in a way that there was a subtle order to what we were offering people, but essentially people were free to look at the documents of the lost works of art, however they chose, and there were cues about people sitting and reading, looking at screens, and the screens were a signal for electronic additional material. In terms of communities, I know that's one of the themes of today. We tried to create a community around the Lost Art Show, and we kept a space for discussion signalled here by empty chairs around some crates, and we kept live blog feeds, live Twitter feeds. We've refreshed the site on a daily basis, and that's what the media company did and did very well. And through all that activity online, we got a substantial audience around the world, and that was fantastic. And through online reach, our company came up with a figure that we reached 3.4 million, which I think that's by association in some way. People were liked the exhibition in many ways, but the one thing that people did, there was only one point of controversy, and that it came down. And that was for us a very important point, that all exhibitions are finite, they belong to a certain period, a certain moment, we took it down. But there was, if we got negative criticism, it was about, can't you keep it up? And that was partly the response of people that the web is a resource. It's an educational resource, and why would you take down something that's good and useful and educational? But we wanted to do an exhibition, and that is the page you now find when you go there. And I just wanted to end by saying that the digital can, with money, and this is a key factor, allow for inventive settings, has enormous potential for storytelling, and which probably more potential than the museum itself. And I think this is something that can be explored with backing. And that, again, the last bullet point is my own personal way of thinking about what the digital can do. And here we are with Twitter as my final point. Bit of a race through, but these are the sorts of things I wanted to mention.
Thank you very much. Okay, are there any immediate questions from the audience?
Down from the active website. Is it archived by the
No, it isn't archived as a site. The assets, a lot of the assets have been kept, not all of them. The main ones, the long essays have been kept and can be accessed on that page. A version of them have been published as a book, so we went from digital to book publishing. So the films, especially made films, have been kept and are on Tate's site, but the site as a whole, the atmospheric wandering around this space, seeing the exhibition grew, I forgot to mention, we didn't set off with a full complement of tables or case studies, we grew it. We started with 20 and grew to 40 over the first 6 months, so we were growing an audience. It was a different approach to audiences. So, no, it's the site, the soundscape and all the other elements, there was a curatorial commentary, all that's gone. And it was about the finiteness of an exhibition, and it was it's very unusual, and I think that's what actually tickled the web communities. They really liked it because it was challenging the norms.
Just to add to that, I mean, it does seem strange when I mean I can imagine it coming down and not being available online, but because technically it's so easy to archive a website, it seemed strange, you know, for those interested in the nature of curation and exhibition, like as an object for the future. Now we won't, I mean, it's been disaggregated and all the elements are there, but it would be quite hard to reassemble them all in the interface.
It's true of any exhibition.
Yeah.
So you want to bring the world up, the museum, in the online world. Whereas most of the time I'm speaking about bringing the digital world in the museum and letting that transform the museum, but you did it the other way around. It's quite interesting.
It was all about having that certain approach to the audience, actually, to build an audience. There was a clock ticking at the bottom line. You have 300 days left, you have 70 days left, you have 11 days and 4 hours left. There was a sense that to build up an excitement around something which doesn't exist, doesn't have walls, doesn't have a publicity campaign per se, that sense that you needed to see it now. You need to keep coming back because it was growing, because otherwise you miss the opportunity. That was a marketing tool or an aspect of a new approach to a digital audience, which was willing to say, we're going to be short-lived, but it's exciting. In the same way that some of the hype around Matisse today is that we know it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We needed to create that.
I mean, I think there's still something about it. It's a bit like Rachel Whiteread's house, which was always supposed to be temporary, and then the campaign built and built to keep it. But of course, its value was entirely in the fact that it's become a myth. It's got a mythical status because it isn't any longer. And I think it's great to have kept the intention. But my question was really also about what the nature of working with ISO was, because the design of this website has become a classic and a reference point for lots of other projects. And I wondered, obviously ISO knew what they were doing when they were designing it. I mean, the whole kind of, you know, topological and topographical approach and the kind of graphics was what was so seductive in also making links laterally across works and connections. But I wondered how working with ISO changed your relationship to the material as it was being presented or choreographed or curated through this exhibition.
ISO were great because they understood and valued the academic side of things. So when I said I wasn't happy with having all the elements pell-mell, they agreed and they worked out a solution because they wanted it pell-mell. It's part of the philosophy, everything's equal in the web and people should be free to choose whatever. I was telling a story, so subtly everything does read from left to right. But we compromised with having, say, groupings of assets so that people could, within a particular phase in the story, they could choose the order. So ISO were a brilliant partner because they understood and welcomed that. They were also brilliant because they came with design references that were very contemporary, that people picked up upon all. So they were referencing the Dogville film, they were referencing police crash scenes. There were lots of cues in the very simple and rather cheap design that people at various levels picked up upon and felt contemporary. But